From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up today on the show, we've got part two of our conversation with officials from the IRS. Today we talk about the effects of the government shutdown on filings and on IRS employees, and about some things to look out for if you're going to a tax preparer.
And if you have someone that says to you up front, I can get you a large refund without running into the numbers through the forms, that is a red flag turnaround. If someone says to you, I'm going to base my charge, my service fee, on a percentage of the refund that I can get back for you, that's another bad sign. Turn around, walk away.
Also today, we visit the Salt Lake County Jail for a new program that aims to bring science education to jail inmates, and your top local headlines just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up a little bit later on the show, we'll have part two of a conversation about taxes, fraud, the government shutdown, and more with officials from the Internal Revenue Service. But first up, we have these headlines. The U.S. House of Representatives has approved a Republican bill to limit the president's ability to designate new national monuments, a step President Barack Obama and other presidents have taken to protect historic or ecologically significant sites. The bill, sponsored by Utah's Representative Rob Bishop, would require an environmental review, including a public hearing, before designation of monuments larger than 5,000 acres. Only one monument per state could be crafted in a president's four-year term. The bill was approved on Wednesday. Bishop and other Republicans have complained that President Obama has designated a half-dozen monuments in the past year without input from Congress. Opponents said the bill was unnecessary, noting that presidents have had authority to create national monuments for more than a century. The legislation is unlikely to pass the Democratic-controlled Senate. In terms of female elected office holders, Utah has one of the lowest participation rates in the country. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, Utah's lawmaking body ranked 46th in the country in female representation, with women comprising just 16.3%. But after this year's election, that percentage could drop even lower. Five of Utah's 17 female legislators will not be running for re-election this year, including House Speaker Becky Lockhart. Is Utah facing a chronic shortage of women in politics? What are the barriers to women thinking about running for office? For a closer look at this issue, KCPW's Ryan Cunningham reports.
2014 is Democratic Representative Jennifer Selig's last year in the Utah legislature, and it's been an impressive tenure. She leaves as a House Minority Leader, after all. She also leaves a legacy of legislation related to women's issues. This year alone, she sponsored bills dealing with how law enforcement handles human trafficking and sexual assault cases. She also sponsored a highly popular bill that establishes a Women in the Economy Commission, a group tasked with collecting data on how Utah's economy is affecting women. Selig says the driving idea behind the new commission is making sure the right questions are asked. That way, lawmakers can make policy decisions that enable, not hinder, the ambitions of Utah women.
A woman contacted me who had been up on the Hill related to a different issue, and she lives in Lehigh and is the primary caregiver of the children at home. And all she wanted to do was to be able to make some money from mending or from sewing, but was having a heck of a time navigating the business license process in the city or in the county there, depending on who was licensing it. And it was so onerous for her. And all her point was, look, I want to be able to spend time with my family and make some money. How can we help facilitate cottage industries so that in some ways that can happen as well?
Selig's bill only received one no vote in both the House and the Senate, making the governor's signature a near formality at this point. But Selig will be gone next year, as will four more of the 17 female legislators. With the possibility of less women representing Utahns, will concern over women's issues diminish?
I think any important, significant body, such as a state legislature, which has a lot of funding authority and a lot of policymaking authority, is much better if it reflects the society that it is supposed to reflect, and that means gender equity or close to it.
That's Cheryl Allen. She served in the Utah House for 16 years and famously ran for lieutenant governor on a bipartisan ticket. Her running mate was Democrat Peter Caroon. Alan now works with Real Women Run, a group she helped to start. The organization is trying to motivate more women to run for public office. And as Alan says, it can be a hard sell getting women into politics.
We know from research, because this actually has been extensively researched throughout the United States, that women need special kinds of encouragement. And that is specifically being asked. Men don't need to be asked. They just see themselves as capable. Women more likely need to be asked, and then they need to be trained so that they have the confidence and the skill set to organize a committee, and frankly, you can't do it without money, and to ask for funding.
Someone who has done the research Alan is referring to is Susan Madsen. Madsen is a professor at Utah Valley University and has studied women's involvement in politics in Utah. She says there's a confidence gap between men and women, which has led to fewer female candidates.
But women will not even consider, oftentimes, that she could apply for a high position or run for office or do, you know, things that are considered leadership. She wouldn't even think about them sometimes until someone approaches her and says, you know, you should do this. You really have, you know, the knowledge and the skills and the voice to do that. And so those are powerful. The research in all areas continue to show that those are powerful things, particularly for women.
House Speaker Becky Lockhart, who is also leaving the legislature this year and, by the way, is a big supporter of CELIG's Women in the Economy Commission, pretty much confirmed Madsen's research with her own observations.
You know, men tend to just think, well, I can be that, and so they go out and do it, where women generally need their friends or someone to come to them and say, you know, you should do this. And they think, really? I should? Yeah, you should. And, you know, and then they do it. But women make really great candidates. And generally are elected. And so the more women we can get interested and willing to run, the more women will be in elected office.
Madsen has talked to numerous prominent women in Utah politics about their personal experiences in an attempt to understand what molded them into leaders. In almost every case, there's what she calls a transformational moment, a moment of inspiration and encouragement that stuck with them.
All of these women could think back to times when they were in third grade or sixth grade or something, and they could remember just moments of people just saying things to them like, you're smart, you can do this, you have a good, you know, you have a voice, you should step forward. And sometimes it was a teacher, sometimes it was a parent or a coach, but they could, even in their 50s and 60s, they could think back to just moments when people would say things that made such a difference to them in the choices they made moving forward.
As it turns out, Alan had a transformational moment herself. Before she served in the House, she was on the Davis County Board of Education. When she visited the Capitol in support of school funding initiatives, something occurred to her.
We were asking for an increase in funding for teacher salaries. Oh my gosh, how common is that? And you know, everyone I knew that it came, the money came from the legislature, but then, oh, I need to be up here advocating for that, and just by sitting in a committee meeting. And each and every woman and each and every man has their own aha moment. For women, it's often related to a cause about which they have a passion.
Alan hopes Real Women Run is a major producer of more transformational moments for women who might not even know they'd make good candidates. The group has been offering training sessions for women curious about running for office or simply getting involved in local politics. Meanwhile, it looks as though the Utah legislature could be losing much of the female influence it's already short on. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
A new partnership between the University of Utah and the Salt Lake County Jail is working to bring a scientific education curriculum to inmates. The new initiative consists of a monthly series of lectures and projects by university scientists and engineers, and its mission falls somewhere between the noble and the practical, to provide an experimental science education to inmates with the aim of inspiring them to improve their own lives. The program, a collaboration between the jail and the university, is offered to minimum security general population prisoners at the Salt Lake County Jail. Here's Nalini Nadkarni, director of the Center for Science and Math Education at the U of U, after spending 2 hours engaging inmates in the first meeting of this monthly program.
It was fantastic. They were paying attention for an hour and a half. They raised their hands. They answered questions. They asked good questions. They seemed very, very engaged. I mean, actually, maybe better than my university students, because I think this is, you know, such a rare thing that they get intellectual stimulation and they're sort of treated as just equals, which they are, of course. So it's just a pleasure to be able to present information that they're hungry for.
Notcarney's presentation to the inmates was on tree biology, tree canopy research, and the ecological importance of forests. She gave a PowerPoint presentation and circulated live cuts of tree branches to help inform the inmates. For 26-year-old inmate Brandon Jimenez, the event was an eye-opener.
I learned a lot from the way that trees age to the way that they tell the age of the tree to how they affect us psychologically. I didn't know trees had such an effect whatsoever, from the air we breathe to our animals to even the bacteria. It was just crazy. Just with them bringing trees in and smelling them, I seen everybody just getting a better mood all the way around, you know?
Aside from giving the inmates an opportunity to better understand science, new research suggests that educational efforts like this one can help to prevent repeat jail time, also called recidivism. A report by the U.S. Department of Justice says inmates who received some kind of educational experience while incarcerated were 43% less likely to end up back in jail. When that report was released in August, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder said that currently, quote, too many individuals and communities are harmed rather than helped by a criminal justice system that does not serve the American people as well as it should, unquote. He called innovative educational programs part of a broader effort to change that. After Notcarney's lecture on Monday, Salt Lake County Prison Captain Matt DeMont said that inmates and society stand to benefit from what he called a minimal investment.
I think most people in jail are good people. They just, at times, they make pretty bad decisions, decisions that can have a very negative impact on their lives. These guys are in here paying their debt, and they're, if we can make them better for when they get out, and maybe we can change some of the thought processes that got them here in the first place, then I think we try and do those things. And really, you know, in terms of cost effectiveness, this is a pretty effective program. It doesn't take a lot of resources to provide a 2-hour lecture on science and take a look to see what kind of impact it's going to make.
49-year-old inmate Brandon Creer said that in some ways the jail was an ideal learning environment for him.
Having this in this type of an environment is really important because you're clean and sober, your system's been flushed out, you're eating healthy again, you're back to the person that you normally are, not the junkie running on the street, not the alcoholic, not the criminal. And so, believe it or not, at least physically, and I think mentally as well, you're at your best in this type of environment. You know, as much as I hate to say that, it's really true. If you're that type of person that's not in that good of shape and doing a lot of drugs and alcohol out there, you know, obviously you're not operating your peak. So in here, you know, you're getting a lot of people suddenly that are, you know, being the bright people that they are and taking advantage of a program like this.
The University of Utah, in collaboration with Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, was awarded a $250,000 National Science Foundation grant to develop a national network to bring science to the incarcerated around the country. Monday's program was a first step in the development of that new national initiative. And that does it for our local headlines today. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the program, we feature part two of our conversation with officials from the IRS. Yesterday, I had a conversation with IRS spokesman Bill Brunson, Utah IRS taxpayer advocate Tammy Angeloff, and Special Agent Virginia Keyes of the IRS's Criminal Investigation Division about identity theft, fraud, implications for tax filings by legally married same-sex couples, and more. Today on the program, we turn our attention to the effects of the government shutdown on the IRS and its employees, an increase in online tax filings, and what to watch out for if you're going to a tax preparer. And we'll pick up that conversation where we left off yesterday. Here's another topic again altogether. We had a government shutdown this last year. It lasted for more than 2 weeks.
About 16 days.
Are there any after effects for your agency and for tax filings that we should be aware of?
Well, the filing season this year started on January 31st. Historically, it starts about the 15th or 16th. That's the first date that you can submit the prior year return, the 2013 return in 2014. Normally would have been January 15th or January 16th, and you could have submitted that electronically. But this year, because of the government's shutdown, delayed processes that we had to go through in order to get ready for the filing season. So we weren't able to open shop until January 31st to allow people to submit their 2013 return. Now, is that going to affect any future dates? No, because you can request an extension if you need to. And it's still plenty of time for folks to gather their records and submit them either on the old-fashioned paper return that has an error rate of 13%, doom, 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 or the current modern way electronically, which has an error rate of less than 0.5%. And 85% of all Utahns are going to e-file. So
it sounds like you're, It sounds like you are trying to impel people to file online.
And all Utahns can go to irs.gov and click on the free file icon and submit their federal income tax return online for free, no matter what the income level is, no matter what the complexity is.
And you can do it for free right there. You don't have to pay an
Correct.
Outside company to do it.
Correct.
Sometimes the state.
Well, that's the cautionary, and Tammy just brought that up, folks. So you want to choose amongst the different software providers if you are using traditional free file to see if they are going to charge you on a state level. Federal level, there's no cost.
Got it.
State level, there could be.
And with that, I'd just like to say, due to the government shutdown, our office saw a large number of influx in cases where taxpayers were trying to close on their homes. Mm-hmm. And January 10th, the law changed on mortgages, and we weren't able to get them account transcripts. And the mortgage companies and the taxpayers and the title companies were, we were inundated with cases. So it did impact the community, and our office worked aggressively as we could. But due to the shutdown and the delay of updating the IRS system, we couldn't get that information out to them.
What happened during those 16 days, out of curiosity for you guys? Were you all, what was it, a hiatus, or did you go to work every day?
Virginia has a different story than Bill.
Okay. And probably than I.
Criminal investigation, because we are federal law enforcement officers, we were required to work during that shutdown. So our investigations continued, but I know Maine and civil also have different stories than that.
Well, none of us knew we were going to get paid, I believe. That's the bottom line.
That's correct. Yeah.
And I had been on board when the last item occurred under President Clinton. So when Bill was in office, we did have a shutdown due to the Speaker of the House.
Right.
But it was for a smaller period of time, and we were not aware of at that point in time whether we would be paid or not, but we were. So this time, they tell us to go home on whatever the date was. And then we find out 16 days later that we're to report back to work. And then we still have that question in our mind, gee, are we going to get paid for this mm-hmm. time? And yes, fortunately, we did. That was very nice of Congress to do that.
But that was the same for us. Even though we had to work, mm-hmm. we didn't know if we were going to get paid for the hours that we still had to put in.
I actually did go up in front of Congress. Well, so every year I go in front of Congress and talk to all the senators and congressmen, and we do work their cases there in the taxpayer advocate's office. But we ask them, please don't shut down the IRS. After all, we are the collection agency for the federal government.
Right.
And it really was a little self-defeating to close us down. And there's a lot of concerns.
Well, and politics plays a hand, in that, you know, for a while there was brinksmanship, et cetera. We could have that conversation, but maybe it's not for this discussion. Before I let you go, I do want to ask about the Affordable Care Act. People have to have insurance or they face a penalty starting in 2014. I've read some media reports that the IRS could conceivably withhold the fine from refunds that were going out.
There is information on the Affordable Care Act on irs.gov. that addresses the current situation. There is a series of questions and answers that may address that particular question that you ask, Roger.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where I would direct your listener to. And as laws are, say, tweaked, changed in this area, then I would go there initially to see how the IRS part of it is playing out. Health and Human Services is the big player in the Affordable Care Act picture. Now, the Internal Revenue Service has items associated with that. So once again, I would go to irs.gov, and there's going to be a whole section of information on the Affordable Care Act where people can go and get good solid answers as to what they could be, should be, need to be doing.
And I mean, I'll just remind listeners that according to the law, you have just another 5 or 6 days to sign up for health insurance under the terms of the Affordable Care Act without incurring a penalty. So if you haven't done that, you might want to investigate that. As we look at people who are waiting to the last minute to get this done. Do you have any advice for citizens who are just now getting ready to file their taxes?
You know, people still have time to file for 2013 to get their records together. Now, 65% of all Americans, which is going to equate to 65% of all Utahns, mm-hmm. are going to go to a paid preparer. And that decision there, they need to do or make it wisely. Choose a paid preparer like you're choosing a physician or a dentist for your family. Choose one that's going to be around after the filing season in case you have a question. You have good preparers and you have bad preparers. Your good preparer will willingly sign the tax return, provide you with a copy of it, have a current preparer tax identification number issued by the IRS that the preparer has gone through the process of obtaining and paying for. Mm. It's an annual renewal. Your good preparer is going to be able to explain everything that is on your return to your satisfaction, to your understanding, and will be able to take advantage of the tax code based on your facts and circumstances. Your good preparer is going to go back to the schoolhouse, continual professional education. Your good preparer is going to ask a gazillion questions. You're going to wonder why on some of this stuff, and they're going to ask for documentation. That way, they can take full advantage of any allowable credit deduction or expense that the code's going to let you do on your return. Oh. So when you go to a paid preparer, choose one wisely. And if you have someone that says to you up front, I can get you a large refund without running into the numbers through the forms, that is a red flag turnaround. If someone says to you, I'm going to base my charge, my service fee, on a percentage of the refund that I can get back for you, that's another bad sign. Turn around, walk away. That lends itself to padding of items on the return and fraud.
Because
it's an incentive for the preparer to not prepare it correctly. Mm. Now, are all preparers bad? Heck no. The majority of them are highly ethical. They learn about the new tax law. They want to do a good job. They do a good job because that's their bread and butter. That's what they do for a living. And they're there for you throughout the year. But you, the taxpayer, are the ultimate responsible party because you're signing that tax return. You're signing a perjury statement that the information is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and ability. So before you sign that return, review it. Never sign a blank return. Now, Virginia's got some information, too, in this area, what to look for or what to watch out for.
Well, and Virginia, maybe I'll ask you if I can, before you begin, if you have criminal cases that involve people doing the kinds of things that Bill is talking about here, padding the returns, et cetera.
We do see those types of investigations, and we end up prosecuting those individuals. And that's one thing that I would definitely add for what Bill said is taxpayers need to be careful who they choose as a tax preparer. I would definitely be careful if they don't have the credentials that you are looking for. If you're not going to file for free over IRS.gov and you're going to choose a preparer, make sure that you have checked the preparer's credentials. Make sure that they are going to sign the return, that you are going to sign the return, and that, frankly, they give you a copy of your return. We see investigations where preparers will go and they will add different things to the return after the taxpayer has already left. Mm-hmm. That can be an issue. And I would also caution tax preparers to know that IRS criminal investigation is aware of you and that we are looking for you and that when we find you, you will be in some hot water and probably face prison time. In fact, we have undercover agents. And so if you are a tax preparer who is possibly filing or preparing and filing fraudulent returns, you never know. You may be preparing a return for an IRS criminal investigation undercover agent.
Wow. And could face prison time as a result. Okay, Virginia Keys,
Special Agent for IRS Criminal Investigation.
Thank you very much for saying that. There are some particular scams that people can become aware of, things that are kind of out there right now. What are they and how can people find out about them?
That's absolutely right. In fact, all taxpayers can go onto IRS.gov and look and find what it's called is the Dirty Dozen. And it's the Dirty Dozen list of tax scams for 2014. And I would absolutely suggest that your listeners and the taxpayers go look up that article. The IRS puts it out. It lists all of the main scams that we are seeing for 2014. Number one is identity theft. Number two are phone scams. And especially since we have seen some of those scams in the Valley, I would suggest that they definitely familiarize themselves with those scams so that if they get a phone call, they'll know it's not not from the IRS, because we don't contact taxpayers by phone or email. They'll get a letter.
Okay, something to be aware of.
Right.
You guys, we are over our allotted amount of time, and so
no.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to call it at that. But I want to thank again Bill Brunson, spokesperson for the IRS, also Tammy Angeloff, a Utah IRS taxpayer advocate, and Virginia Keys of the IRS's Criminal Investigation Division. Thanks to all of you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
And again, that was part two of our conversation with officials from the IRS. You can find both segments as well as all of the conversations we've had on the program at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're tuned into The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks again for tuning in this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow we'll be exploring the contents of a new book, Broadcasting Buildings, which takes a look at architecture programs that ran on the BBC in the first half of the 20th century. We'll be talking to Shandana Yusuf, an architectural historian at the University of Utah, about her book and the early days of the BBC. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for the Utah Business Report and Marketplace.